A Star Trek stamp.
We're always discussing Star Wars. This is a Star Wars / stamp podcast.
/ Batman
podcast.
/ Star Trek.
Yeah. I need to find more Star Trek stuff. There's just not that much. U.S. did one stamp.
It's a Star Trek stamp.
Jessica,
why is it here?
Because Jessica was on the Star Trek stamps, and I said, okay.
Oh, because I went like this and went... Mm-hmm. Jessica said, Cash will kill you. I'm like, does Cash care about this stamp?
Don't be licking my stamps, man.
It's like a 90.
I wanted to get 100. None of them showed up.
Not that one.
How many sheets did we rip apart?
Or all
you
the
rip
sheets.
Apart?
Eight or ten.
Well, I got the 100 one. Super Bowl. I went the 100 Star Trek. Don't care about the rest.
But if I find it first?
Well, then you can sell it to Cash.
No.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
I'll find a grade 100 Hello Kitty stamp and I'll
change it. Oh, there we go.
Hold it hostage.
Ouch.
You cut the baby in half. We each get half.
It'll never get 100 because when Jessica sees it in scanning, it'll disappear.
Five, four, three, two, one.
This is Wayne Youngblood with Regency Superior Auctions, and you're listening to Stamp Show Here Today.
Return to send up. Welcome to Stamp Show Here Today, podcast number 19. I'm sitting here with Scott, Kaz, Tom, and Jeff, and I'm your host, Jessica. You can find us on Facebook at Stamp Show Here Today and on Twitter at Stamp Show HT. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes and Stitcher. Let's talk about stamps. So this week we'll be talking about stamp news, the inclusion of the right side up Jenny sheet in the Scott catalog, # stamp stories, Valentine's Day and stamps, and our expert topic of the week is Postmaster Provisionals. Stamp news. Lins reports that United States Breast Cancer Research Summer Postal Stamp, or Scott Catalog B1, has raised over $80 million since its release in July of 1988. So why do you think this stamp was more successful than any of the other semi-postal?
Well, I think it's more successful because it's been going on forever.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if they started selling these in 1851, you know, they started selling
this when the first class letter rate was 32 cents.
Yeah, this has been out there for a long time.
I remember those stamps.
You still buy them on their website? I just saw them.
No, I would just. It was when I saw you say B1, it popped into my head B cup. And I'm going, I'm sorry. Total off. Sorry. Never mind. Anyway, I just bought a sheet of Imperf ones because they're going to be included in the catalog. I know we're going to talk about this later. But they're still selling Imperf press sheets of it.
Oh.
So I got one. It's in the mail somewhere to me right now.
So do you think it did well because it was very specific?
No, I think it did well because I bought one of the press sheets and they pocketed that money and they're running off to the bank with it.
Well, so you're saying you paid like $79.9 million for that one press sheet and that's what it came from? Good grief.
Well, Cash is on a one-man mission to save the Tatas.
There you go. What is the premium, by the way, on it?
It's 11 cents.
11 cents?
Yeah. It beat out the endangered species by quite a bit, and I think it's because it talks about endangered species, not endangered
tatas.
Fill in the blank.
Yeah.
Well, animals. It wasn't very specific. It was just like, save the animals that are endangered.
Yeah.
But it shows a tiger.
Yeah.
Yeah, but are tigers endangered?
Yes.
Some of them are. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Jessica and I...
It's one of those big wild animals that you find out in the wilds of California.
Calvin had one. His name was Hobbs. Cricket noise here.
More like head shaking.
Oh.
Yeah, that.
No, Jessica and I were talking about this earlier, and I just don't think it would have done well if it was just a cancer research stamp. It's because it was a specific topic.
Well, they did have a cancer research stamp. I believe.
Well, I was. They have a documentary coming out, I think, in June. It's by a very famous film crew. I forget the name of the film crew, but they're talking about bringing dinosaurs back to life. And the documentary is going to be in, like, the movie theater. So I think that, you know, anything that goes extinct, all we need to do is find some DNA from a mosquito and ship it off to those guys.
Pull the other one.
About Jurassic World, the movie.
Well, you know Cash and his deadpan humor.
And his dead humor.
Oh, no.
Yeah, well.
Well, $80 million.
Potato, potato.
Hopefully half of it got to actual scientific research.
Yeah,
hopefully. Do we want to ask where the other half went?
To the Tatas.
No, probably went to, probably went to
Jurassic,
like,
Tatas.
No, it goes to designers and publicity people and the administrators who handle the money and the administrators who handle the administrators who handle the money and the HR department who does all the paperwork for the administrators that handle the administrators that handle the money and et cetera.
Don't forget the president's cut.
And the president's cut. Not Barack Obama.
He gets no Tata money.
Yeah, but if we were talking about ears, then... Then he could've.
There's no ear cancer stamp. Sorry.
So yeah. I wonder what the okay. So it outdid the endangered species list. So obviously, it way outdid the 9/11 issue.
Well, the 9/11 issue was only on sale for a short period, for like a year.
Yeah.
It or 2 years or whatever it was authorized for. It was never renewed.
Huh.
And the breast cancer stamp has been renewed over and over and over.
Yep.
So what was the first year it was released?
1988.
27 years. So, I mean, you split that up, that's only $3 million a year.
Only? For a stamp?
Yeah.
It's a lot.
At 11 cents a stamp.
Yeah.
Holy crap. That's just the surcharge. Yeah. That's the surcharge.
Okay, so Forbes is at it again, talking about postage stamps. And actually something called an auction agent, which I hadn't heard before. Forbes contributor Richard Lehman wrote a unique piece called Are Stamp Auction Agents for You? If you are considering buying high-value stamps at your local reputable auction house as an investment opportunity...
Disclaimer here. We're not supposed to be speaking about stamps as investment vehicles. That being said, let's discuss them as investment vehicles.
The sentence started with if.
Oh, yes.
If. Yes, there you go.
Oh, there's a disclaimer. There you go.
So here are a few things to consider. Most auction houses have made many different avenues available to buyers of high-end stamps, especially with the rapid growth of internet over the last 15 years. In addition to mail-in bids with set limits, bidders can join in on the phone, in person, or participate online. However, consider that it is always in the best interest of the house to ensure that an item sells for a maximum profit. Both the auction house and the auctioneer make their cut based on the percentage of the total sale price. So the higher bids, the higher the profit. At this point, it may be wise to employ a different tactic and hire a personal auction agent. An auction agent can take your place on an auction floor, whether it is to maintain anonymity or to be physically present on your behalf when you simply cannot attend an auction in person. Oftentimes, an auction agent can save you more money than he costs over the duration of the auction. He can protect against fabricated bids, keep your maximum bid secret, act as your eyes and ears when expecting a lot in person.
Comma.
Know when your bid is being unfairly run up, retract bids openly on the floor, and have a personal sense of the tactics being used by the auctioneer.
Wait. You mean unfairly run up? How does that happen?
Personal attacks.
I have this story about a auction company that I will not name the name, and it wouldn't matter if I did because they went out of business like in the 1990s. But there was an auction that I was at, and a person was bidding, and the auctioneer would point to the person, then point to the back of the room, point to the person, point to... And the guy was looking at the back of the room to see who he was bidding against. And finally, he said, stop, 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 who am I bidding against? And everybody in the house knew he was being run up. He wasn't bidding against anything.
He was bidding against the auctioneer.
They said he was bidding against the water chair. Cooler. Yeah, yeah.
Or
the
he was bidding against the darkness.
And so they started over again, and he did his bid, and nobody else bid. And the auctioneer, I thought it was the funniest thing, because the auctioneer said, "You intimidated the other bidder." And this guy was nobody. I mean, nobody knew who he was or anything. It's like he had no intimidation power. "You intimidated the other bidder. This is your last lot. Get out at the auction." And what everybody really heard what he said is, "You caught me running up the bids. You're out of the auction." It does happen very, very rarely. And the people who do it are pretty much put out of business. Like I said, this guy went out of business a long time ago. Generally speaking, it's not so much that you're run up, but there is a potential for somebody, you know, if you ever watch the old Dick Van Dyke where the guy scratches his nose and places a bid, you don't want to be bidding against accidental bids.
Or two secretaries.
Oh, tell that story.
Oh, you've told that story on the podcast before.
Yeah. So there is, that's not a fear that you should really worry about, but it can happen.
Auction agents typically work for a flat fee per item or a small percentage of the total spent, generally around 3 to 5%. When compared to the savings that auction agent might earn you, the fee is almost nominal. Consider a situation without an agent. You may pay $12,000 for a lot, but with his help, you can pay $10,000. If the agent works at the top end, collecting 5%, he has collected a fee from you for only $500. This lot has cost you $10,500 in total, and you have saved an extra $1,500. This well justifies the cost.
Yeah, just as a note, the number one replacement for auction agents is when you're mailing in your bid. If you're doing it on the phone, or if you're sophisticated enough to do it online or something like that, generally speaking, you can duplicate what an auction agent does. But if you're mailing in your bids, you really should spend the 3%. No question about it.
I disagree because the auction agent is actually sitting on the floor and he can see who else is bidding.
Does that matter?
Because if I'm bidding against Bill Gross, I'm out.
Well, but why? But why?
Let's pretend Bill Gross.
If you have a number, yeah. He has a number. His number has the potential to be larger than yours because he has a deeper pocket, mm-hmm. but it may not necessarily be a larger number
than
yours.
But he's got all the stamps, so he may not need that one.
Yeah, but what if he decides to go into worldwide?
He already has.
Then you're in trouble.
No, you do have a point there, but who you bid against shouldn't necessarily matter unless it's a friend.
Well, even then.
And then you're not supposed to let that affect you.
I mean, legally it's called collusion. When you just decide that you're not going to bid against your buddy.
That's actually
buddy.
If you talk to each other.
Yeah. Well,
but if your buddy raises his hand and you raise your hand and you look at each other and one of you puts down the hand, that's not necessarily collusion.
No, that's true.
It's not benefiting the auction house, and it's definitely not assisting the seller because, you know, if the two people who are bidding are friendly to each other, and one of them is willing to pay $1,000 and the other one's willing to pay $900, then it should sell for $950.
I don't know.
But you see the number up and all of a sudden you drop it at $700. You know, it's like, okay, you helped your friend, but you did a disservice to the seller, which, you know.
Yeah, but at that point, somebody else might raise their hand because they say, oh, well, that's a good deal. I think I'll get in on that.
Yep.
So,
well, another thing to me for an auction agent is with somebody on the floor like that, if you're not there and you're relying on the phone or online bidding, you know, you're relying on that technology to get your bid in before the auction closes.
Well,
I've seen people, Scott actually, I was watching him, he was bidding on a lot and the lot closed and he had bid more than the final cost.
Yeah.
His bid didn't go through. Because and he wasn't on the floor, but the online bid failed to make it in, which was higher than the selling price.
Well, the other thing, too,
here's... Well, I've also seen that happen sitting on the floor, and... You know, 30 seconds after the lot's hammered, they've already started the next lot, and all of a sudden they get another bid for the last lot.
Yeah.
And depending on which auction house it is, they may or may not reopen the lot and continue the other lot. But, I mean, technology still has its limitations.
That, I think, is unfair to the people on the floor, though, too, because...
It is.
The guy thinks he bought it, done, and now you're going to say, oh, wait, we're just kidding.
It's definitely unfair.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean,
it's like if you were sitting on the floor and you raise your... Oh, wait a minute. I meant to bid on that last lot.
Right. You can't do that.
They would say, well, sorry, you're out of luck. You didn't raise your hand.
Well, another thing is that you can overbid yourself. And an auction agent won't. Like, you put down... I want to pay $550 for that stamp, and then you're sitting on the floor, and all of a sudden it goes for $650, and you go,
seven.
So it does also give you a little bit of your...
You start pulling out your wallet and counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, I can go one more.
Yeah.
I don't know about you guys, but I'm easily intimidated. So if I was bidding, like it happened at the last auction I went to at a stamp club, I wanted something really bad. There was four different versions of the same thing. There were sheets to put your stamps in. I didn't win a single one because people started looking at me. And then I was like... Let them have it.
Stare back.
Yeah.
I was just done. Well, I mean, I bid up the first, like, two or three, and then the third one, and then the fourth one, they were just staring at me like, stop raising the price, you. And I was like, oh, I'm just going to sit
here.
Well,
you got to start holding up your paddle like this.
Well, you weren't the one raising the price. Somebody else was raising the price.
Yeah, it takes two people to raise a price.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell them to quit bidding so you can get it.
I was just like, if they're not going to let me have it, I'm not going to.
The other guy didn't need all four lots.
I know he didn't. I wanted one. I just wanted one.
Yeah, he did kind of take all four. That was like, why?
That was pretty rude.
Yeah. So what auction agent show up to your stamp club there?
I'm going to have to hire one, apparently.
I'm available.
Scott, get it.
Yeah, that's another thing. I can be intimidating at auctions. At the stamp club, people turn around and see me bidding, and it's like, oh,
nope.
I'm not going to bid against him.
Okay, so great news. Nagging does work. No, I shouldn't use that, huh?
All we need is for Chad to hear that.
What? So great news. The 2016 Scott catalog will recognize a rare Jenny sheet. Lens reports that a rare right-side-up Jenny sheet will be recognized and given a lowercase letter listing in the 2016 catalog. When the USPS announced that they would be printing 100 of the 6 stamp panes of the C3A reissue right-side-up, prices offered for a single sheet skyrocketed overnight. Despite the buzz, the Scott Catalog Company maintained that the sheet did not follow their guidelines for receiving a Scott Catalog number. Our guest on Episode 17, Chad Snee of Lens, said that the Scott editors and I felt that it was not a listable item. It was an intentionally produced variety that was issued in a very low quantity. Scott, as outlined in its listings policy, does not provide catalog numbers for such items. The pane, which has been purchased by several retail stamp sellers for over $50,000 a sheet, had until this announcement only received a mention in a footnote, an addendum to the Scott catalog number 4806. 4806 is the entry for the regular pane of reissued C3As, of which 1 million have been produced and still can be found at your local post office for $12 a sheet. Upon making the footnote decision public, Scott Publishing received quite a few responses from dealers and collectors alike, citing many reasons why the uninverted pane should receive more than just a mention. Reasons include the fact that it technically is offered for sale through the USPS, they are valid for postage, and the issuing country has a valid post office. Apparently, the editors of Scott Catalog have been persuaded and will also include the imperforate stamps from the uncut press sheets without die cuts. as the new Circus sheet and, of course, the Batman sheet. What do you think? Should these two exceptions to the Scott catalog rules be added to the catalog? Or do you think that the editors have been swayed from their standards by popular opinion? Let us know on Facebook, Twitter, or by calling our Google Plus voicemail.
Actually, I have an opinion on that.
Surprise.
I think that they were persuaded because they only have two concrete listing criteria. One is an operating postal service for that country, which obviously we have. And two is that the stamps issued are valid for postage and available in the country.
Which they are.
So, I'm really glad they came to that decision.
Yeah.
So all the other listing criteria are basically
floaters.
Artificial. Really, when I talked with Chad afterwards, he was starting to have a change of heart at that point and said that they really shouldn't be looking for reasons not to list an issue. They should be looking for reasons to include an issue in the catalog. And so I think those conversations and that attitude is really kind of what changed the whole mood.
I do still feel like it will become a normal thing. It's not just this year or last year. It should be, might be forever they might do this.
Well, the Imperf Press sheets, they've been doing that sequentially for a couple of years now, haven't they?
The special printings of 1875 were initially not included in the catalog. And over the years, they've been included. And this is something that was bound to happen as time goes on because people want to buy and sell them. They have them. They're out there in enough quantities that people will include them in their collections. And it facilitates a dealer buying and selling that sort of material. It also facilitates the collector in knowing what his collection is worth. So it's absolutely worth putting in the catalog. And I think they've made the right decision.
This week in stamp collecting history, we're going to get all mushy on you guys because it's Valentine's Day is coming up. And I had no idea there was a history of the Valentine in America that was different from England. So in 1850, Esther Howland, an American printer and artist, was among the first to publish and sell Valentines in the United States. She later sold the thriving business to George C. Whitney Company. Esther Howland graduated from Mount Holyoke Women's Seminary in 1847. Through Mount Holyoke, she did not celebrate St. Valentine's Day. Students often secretly exchanged poems elaborately scrawled on sheets of paper. After her graduation, Howland received an ornate English Valentine from a business associate of her father's when she was 19 years old. Intrigued with the idea of making similar Valentines, she began her business importing lace paper and floral decorations from England. At this time, elaborate Valentine's greeting cards were imported from Europe and not affordable to most Americans. Her father operated the largest book and stationery store in Worcester, Massachusetts, and ordered supplies for her project. She made dozens of samples, which her salesman brother added to his inventory on his next sales trip, hoping for about $200 worth of orders. She was elated when he returned with over $5,000 worth of business for her. Howland employed friends and developed a thriving business in Worcester, Massachusetts, using an assembly line. She named her business the New England Valentine Company. Her Valentines became renowned throughout the United States, and she was called the Mother of the American Valentine. Her business eventually grossed over $100,000 per year, a considerable sum for that time. She eventually sold the business to George Whitney in 1881 after many successful years. Every February, Valentine's cards became a staple addition to regular mail. Beginning in 1973, the concept of love migrated from the Valentine card to the postage stamp, giving rise to a numerous series of love stamps featuring, over the years, images ranging from Robert Indiana's love sculpture in 1973, a puppy for 1986, flowers in 1988, lovebirds in 1999, Cupid in both 1995 and 1996, John Adams' love letters to his wife in 2001, and tiny heart candies for 2004. In 1987, the USPS decided to issue an annual love stamp, popular not only for Valentine's Day, but wedding invitations and other special occasions.
Now they issue them in two denominations, the 1 cent, the 1 ounce and the 2 ounce rates, so that you can mail your invitation using the 2 ounce rate, and then you can prepay the postage on the RSVP with the 1 cent rate.
That's why they do that.
Because wedding Valentines usually have extra weight to them because of all the stuff included. So that's why they issue two every year with us with a combination design.
Cool.
When we issued our wedding invitations, we went overboard. And yeah. I guess wax seals weigh a little bit.
Oh, I remember that.
We spent a lot of time at the post office just sticking stamps everywhere.
We had a stack of 150 invitations, and we weighed them before we put the seal on them and knew what the rate was and went to drop them off. The postal clerk went, nope. So we spent a half hour in the post office with rolls of stamps sitting there on every single one of these dumb things and redoing them.
Well, that extra touch of love costs a little extra.
Yeah, well.
They look cool, though.
They did.
Yes, wedding invitations are getting to the point where some of them, I think, need to just be included in a flat rate box.
I haven't seen one of those yet.
I haven't said I've seen one yet, but I've said they're getting close. I've gotten some pretty huge, heavy wedding invitations.
Here's our wedding invitation book.
Right.
Update. So I have a little bit of an update. I actually went on postcrossing.com and got a postcard buddy, and he's in Germany. Very specific about what he wanted his postcard, but I think I hit it on the nail. And I'll post a picture of it after it arrives because I don't want you really talking about it before the person gets it. It's supposed to be like a surprise in the mailbox.
What, how is he specific? I'm curious.
He wanted architecture, something specific to your city, certain stamps related to certain topics like angels and churches and music. And it was really specific.
Wow.
It was like five paragraphs.
You sure he doesn't submit stuff? Because I know of a couple of guys that act like that.
Well, some stamp collectors are really specific about what they like, so I got one of those.
Any collector is passionate about what they collect, so.
Took a very German approach to it, though. Specific things.
Now you're just profiling.
I enjoyed the challenge. I enjoyed the challenge. And I found, like 5 pounds of postcards at the thrift store for $2.
5 pounds
from around the world.
She's not kidding. It's a stack that's about this thick of unused postcards from all over the place.
Oh. They put it as a sack of crap, but I saw it as an opportunity.
Stack of crap.
Yeah. Well, it's like in their little like broken pencils and crayons. It's next to those sacks.
Yeah.
And then I found that and I was like, hello.
For this listener question thing. I'm sorry. I'm reading ahead. Says we will give you the answer and picture next week. Well, if they can't guess if we can't give them the picture. I think we should give them the picture this week and say it's on our Facebook page.
Oh, now you're making it easy.
No, give them the picture and they get we got the picture.
Yeah, really.
Fine.
We could do that.
I'm just saying it'd be something neat. It's a challenge for the listeners.
How long did you look for it, Jeff?
I looked for it for...
Well, why don't we talk about it first?
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, I think we should post it this week and say, if you want to go to the Facebook page, can you find out what this stamp is?
Yeah.
And
I almost thought that could be kind of an interesting weekly thing. There's got to be oddballs out there like that.
Give them
more than one.
So our listener questions, we're actually going to pass this one on to our Facebook and Twitter followers. It's a challenge to ID a stamp with no name of the country and only the denomination. The numeral 8 and a simple orange artwork motif. The only other clues is that it has post horns in the corner and is frequently used in Europe with the word post at the bottom. Can you guess the stamp? We'll put the picture up on our Facebook and give you the answer next week. You can email your answer to Stampshire Here Today, or you can hit us up on Facebook and Twitter with private messages, no giving away the answer online until we decide the listener who the winner is.
That's whoever gets it to us first, right?
Oh, I guess. The first listener with the right answer will receive a 4806A used that has been encapsulated by professional stamp experts. So send your answers quick before someone else does.
So on this stamp, I'm going to elaborate just a little bit. I'm the one that got the Facebook question. I spent 20 minutes on my phone without a catalog trying to find it. That was impossible. If you Google Orange 8 stamp horn, you're never going to find it. Just to give you a heads up, throw Google out the window. Then I spent about 10 minutes with the Scott catalog on my own. I knew it was European. That's one of your clues. It is a European stamp. Could not figure out which country. I knew there were several countries that used post horns on their stamps. So about 10 minutes on my own, and then Cash walked by, and he said, "Oh, I think it might be blah, blah, blah." And he got closer to it, but it was still a really obscure stamp, so it's getting a little deeper. So after he mentioned that, I spent about 5 more minutes looking, and finally I gave up, and I said, "Scott, what is this?" And he's like, "Oh, that's a blah, blah, blah." Forehead slap. That took him, he didn't know the exact Scott number, but he knew exactly what it was, what country it came from, and it took him about 30 seconds to find it in the book. So
he knew the most important part, where to look.
Oh, yeah. So it is possible. Somebody did ID it. Good luck.
Okay, so I'd like to give a shout out to and a special thanks to David B. Robinson at Your Great CPA on Twitter for posting a unique picture of his discovery of the 18th uninverted invert sheet on our Twitter feed, and for his kind words saying, "Thanks for featuring me in the podcast and changing the future of the hobby with your podcast, Brava, and your role modeling to girls too." That I love these words of encouragement because it really keeps us going.
Yes.
We know people are listening.
Yay.
Yay.
Okay, joining us today is Stanley Piller of Stanley M. Piller & Associates of Walnut Creek, California. You can find his website. It's www.smpiller.com. He literally wrote the book on this topic, and just about every discussion on Postmaster Provisionals references his work. So can you tell us, what is the definition of a Postmaster Provisional?
Before I go into the definition of a Postmaster Provisional, a little bit of history. In 1840, Great Britain issued the first stamp. By 1842, technically the United States was using a stamp in New York City as part of its carrier service, the City Dispatch Post, that it had. By 1845, there was much interest in introducing stamps into the United States. So Robert H. Morris, who was postmaster of New York City, wanted the post office to issue stamps, and they decided as an experiment to let the city of New York issue stamps. A postmaster provisional is a stamp that was issued by the postmaster of one of the cities for use in the cities on mail to, through, or from those cities. So, for example, in New York City, a stamp showing a picture of George Washington was produced and sold, and you could use this stamp to signify that the postage was paid on mail to, through, or from New York only. There were other cities that did the same. St. Louis did it. Brattleboro did it. Baltimore did it. St. Louis did it. Just to name a few of the cities where the postmasters eventually issued stamps that were valid on the following conditions. They had to be used from the city for the most part. They had to have the word paid on the envelope to signify that the postage was paid. And in some cases, they had to have the signature of the postmaster, similar to way the mail, you know, the free franking mail was done, to signify that the postmaster authorized it, etc. So in New York, Robert H. Morris and his assistants sign the stamps, and you have these are like control markings, or basically, I don't want to use the word pre-canceled because they weren't canceled. They were just an indication that they were authorizing the use of those stamps to be sold. And you find most of the New York provisionals, as an example, sign either ACM for Alonzo C. Monson, who was one of the clerks there, or occasionally Robert H. Morris signed it. But you do see them signed, and those are not cancels. An unused stamp can have those control signatures on it, and it's considered an unused stamp. Rattleboro had the stamp signed. Baltimore basically had the name of the postmaster, James Buchanan, which was not the president, but the same name, also signed it. Subsidies, they didn't sign it. That's what basically a provisional is. It's called a provisional because it was used only provisionally in those cities or mailed to those cities in the case of New York or through those cities in the case of New York. New York, I believe, is the only postmaster provisional use that has mail going to, through, or naturally, where most of them are, from New York City going out. And they have to have the word paid on them. Otherwise, wherever they ended up, they would assume that the postage wasn't there, even though it had a stamp, and they would charge the recipient. Does that explain it?
Yes, this is Cash. I'm just curious, if the postage was considered paid, did the U.S. Post Office tell all the cities that, hey, we've got these stamps coming out of New York. If it shows up, this is what it is? Or did they just really rely just on the fact that it said paid on the envelope?
If an envelope had the word paid on it, the postmaster of whatever city the mail was addressed to automatically knew that the postage was paid, even though it may not have had the rate on it.
So the stamp...
The paid was an indication that the postage was paid.
So, I mean, obviously the stamp is for prepayment, but really for the paid stamping is more important than the actual stamp itself then?
The postage stamp has a denomination on it indicating what the rate is. For example, the New York Postmaster's provisionals was 5 cents. In St. Louis, they had 5 cent stamps, 10 cent stamps, and 20 cent stamps. In Providence, they had 5 cent stamps and 10 cent stamps. The rate on the stamp indicated what the rate was that was being paid. None of the stamps had the word paid on them. They had to cancel it, not so much the stamp, but mark the envelope paid to indicate to the postmaster receiving the letter that the postage was paid. And that was the way things were handled during the stampless period.
Interesting.
And it was that method of use that followed through. The stamp, all the stamp did was indicate what the rate was that was being paid to the New York City postal clerk who marked it paid. It wasn't the postmaster who marked them paid. It was the clerk receiving the mail or whoever they had marking the envelopes. So when you went to the post office and you wanted to pay the postage on a stampless cover, you had to physically hand the clerk money. That's why on railroad covers, you never see the word paid because the clerks were not allowed to take money because of train robberies. Most people don't realize it, but you never see the word paid on a cover originating from a train. Unless it, you know, now if they had a stamp on there, it was a different thing. That's a later time. But all the stampless covers are unpaid. You couldn't pay the clerk money for the postage.
So why was the creation of these stamps necessary?
Because people felt that why would somebody have to run when the post office was open to pay a letter? If you could put a stamp on it and throw it in the mailbox, when they took the mail out of the box, those letters that had stamps on it, they can mark it paid, knowing that the postage was paid by something. It indicated prepayment.
Prepayment was a fairly new concept at the time, right?
Well, by 1845, it had been in use for at least 5 years, especially in Great Britain. In our country, the prepayment of mail to and from other post offices, or, you know, wherever they were, started literally with the New York Postmaster Provisional. Technically, Scott number one should be the New York Postmaster's Provisional, because it paid a rate.
Just curious.
It paid the first class rate. And for many years, number one was the New York Postmaster's Provisional.
That's what I was just going to ask. In the old Scott catalog system.
The old catalogs, that's what it was.
Yep.
And people considered it number one. If the New York Postmaster's Provisional would be considered number one, and the number one and number two that we call number one and two, different numbers, the values of the New York Provisional would rise dramatically, in my opinion.
Well, that was actually going to be one of our questions.
Sorry if I jumped the gun.
Oh, no problem. We're always doing that around here.
Now, the New York Postmaster Provisional stamp also is technically the first U.S. stamp that's found on mail going outside the U.S. You find it on mail to England, to Italy, to Germany, all different countries. There's even one going to Mexico, and obviously Canada. The reason you find it, because as the postage being paid was usually the 5 cent British mail rate or the nickel for the U.S. postage. It was paying the U.S. domestic postage. At that time, there were no treaties with other countries where you could pay to England. That didn't come in much later.
Well, you sort of brought it up, but what are some of your favorite items that you had?
In Postmaster's Provisional?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one time, I and two other dealers owned the Annapolis Provisional cover, and we sold it. I was involved in the New York Provisional with the block of nine on it. Those are some of the more valuable ones. I've had a lot of interesting New York Provisional covers. At one time, I owned the St. Louis Provisional that was missent to New York City.
So tell us about that one. What was it?
It was one of the Charlie and Waylon cover that was missent to New York. It ended up in New York rather than in Philadelphia. And it had the words missent stamped on it. And I owned it, and it was in a very famous St. Louis Provisional collection. I sold it to Bob Feynman in the mid-80s. There are a lot of... I've handled... In 40 years of being a dealer, I've handled quite a few covers in my time. And just to say, oh, this is my favorite, people ask me, I really don't have one favorite. It depends what it is. There's so many different things that are interesting.
Stanley, coming back to the introduction where Jessica indicated that you had written the book on this, how long did it take you to actually plate the Postmaster Provisionals of New York?
Well, I wasn't the one that originally plated with them. They were originally plated, oh, God, almost 100 years ago. 90 years ago they were plated, 90 to 100 years ago the plating was done. And there are 40 stamps, 40 positions, and the plating is, they've been reconstructed. I've even put together reconstructions. I have an overlapping pair reconstruction that I'm still, to this day, still working on. And there are just lots of, you know, reconstructions that have been put together because there are 40 stamps, and each one is pretty defined, and you can almost—it's very easy to plate the stamps. If you go to my book on the New York Postmaster's Provisionals, I show the diagrams and how to plate each of the positions. So the reason for the book, I had a client, Dr. Leonard Kapeloff, who was interested in the New Yorks, and he decided he wanted to collect them and put together a collection. And I convinced him that it should be done my way, not just the postal history, which he was interested in. So I put together, with his money, obviously.
Why does that not surprise us?
A collection of New York provisionals, which today is still intact and still owned by the family, which has the essays, the proofs, a mint plating, a used plating, and a great number of the great New York provisional items. Two covers to Texas. It has the Black and Nine on cover. You know, first days, everything. It's just a debate. If you go through the book, you'll see a lot of the items. That was the basis for the book. And after we had put together the collection and put together an exhibit, Leonard said, why don't you write a book on it? So I said, okay. And he basically paid for the book to be published and printed, produced it, and sold it.
And now you're a famous author.
Well, I don't know that I'm famous, but, you know, if I were to do it today, there would be it would be totally in color, although technically you're talking about a black and white
Not a whole lot of color anyway.
So, you know, technically the book's in color for the old prints, the blue, you know, the ACM in blue and the cancels, which were in red for the most part. But, yes, and the book would be printed probably differently today. It's so much easier to produce a book today than it was when we did it, in 1989. I can't believe how long it has been.
Stanley, what can you tell us about forgeries of the New York Postmaster Provisional?
Well, the New York Postmaster Provisional has forgeries that were done by Sperati. He used, I believe it's position 29. And that, whenever you see a position 29, you should check to see whether it's a Sperati or not. But they're very easy to tell. The New York Postmaster Provisional is a stamp that's engraved. Sperati did not engrave the stamp. He used photography. I think it's lithography he used or whatever it is. All I will say is that if you were to take a New York provisional stamp and hold it at an angle, you could see the raised lines. On the Sperati's, you don't see the raised lines. It's flat. So the Sporades are literally very easy to identify. And there were some photographic mistakes he made in the design, or in that were mistakes in the stamp. So if you read my book where I talk about the Sporades, I identify the two different types of Sporades that he made.
Which
and the
is,
paper isn't the same either.
Yes, but which is
very,
more valuable?
He did a very good job. He did a very good job on it, but it's still a forgery and a fake.
Yeah, but which
and I never really handle them. Because I really don't like to sell forgeries and fakes. Even though technically you can probably own them because the stamps were demonetized or supposedly demonetized. And they're not covered by the counterfeit laws.
Yeah, but which stamp is worth more? I mean, Sporades forgeries tend to be kind of valuable, and I'm kind of wondering if the real stamp or the Sporades is more valuable.
The real stamp, in my mind.
Oh, in your mind. Oh, yeah.
And you want to know something? I would never sell a Sporades for what I would sell the equivalent conditioned New York provisional.
Fair enough. Fair
In
enough.
Fact, I don't sell Sporades. People have asked me for them. I never buy them, and I never sell them because to me, they're just an interesting sideline. Even though Topaloff in his collection, I think we put a page of Sporades in as part of the story of the stamp in his collection, and I see nothing wrong with that. But to me, you lend credence to somebody to... When you sell a forgery, I don't care who made it, you're lending credence to the fact that it's a forgery and it doesn't deserve it.
Fair enough.
A forgery is a fake. I don't care who made it.
Okay, now the $99 question. You keep referencing your book and saying, if you read my book, where can someone get your book?
Can I raise my hand?
Absolutely.
I still have not many. At one time, I had a lot more over the years, but
well, that's a good sign.
20 years, in almost 20 years, actually, in 15, 16, 17 years of having the book, I still have a limited number of books for sale at the same price I've always sold them for,
which is
$75 postpaid.
So, give yourself, consider this a commercial.
Well, if anybody,
because it is a great book. I've seen the book. It is a fantastic book.
Yeah, it tells everything you need to know about the New Yorks. And if anybody wants it, all they have to do is send me a check for $75 to my P.O. Box 559 Alamo, California 94507. And if they want it autographed, I'll autograph it. I don't care.
Whoa. What a deal. Autograph, too. How many originally did you make? This
300.
Is 300. So it's a very limited supply.
Very limited, yeah. We did, at the time, well, we printed a hell of a lot more. And unfortunately, all the remainder unbound stuff was thrown out many years ago. We did a little bit of a survey on, at the time, how many philatelic books like that normally sell. We figured we'd print 300 and we'd sell maybe 200. And you want to know something? That's about what we sold, about 200.
Yeah, but now you have the power of the podcast behind you.
I understand.
Be prepared for those things to be shooting off your shelf.
This is a very specialized book on a specialized stamp, and we knew what the interest would be. Not every collector of U.S. is interested. Like I said, if this had been number one, a book on... If the New York Provisional was number one, believe me, there would have been a lot more books sold and a lot more interest in it.
You'd be up there with Anne Rice.
I don't think so. Don't even put me in the same category.
Well, you know, what's interesting, what sparked the topic is that I was at Sandy Cal and saw an exhibit on it. And then I was reading an encyclopedia about stamp collecting, and there it was again, and it was on referencing your material. So it seems like, I don't know if interest is growing or people are more interested in stuff.
I have, if I may say so, I have more than a handful of collectors who are interested in collecting the New York Postmaster Provisional. There's even somebody in Sweden who has a very credible collection of the New York Postmaster's Provisional. And in the United States, I know of three or four serious collectors of it. And every time I get something different, it doesn't usually hang around long.
But also explain to people how much they're worth, and that's one of the reasons why they're, you know.
Well, I believe the basic stamp catalog's about $500 plus or minus. Now we're not talking faulty copies. We're not talking less than four margin copies, because I personally don't even, you know, unless if there was something exceedingly rare about it, I wouldn't even look at less than a four-margin stamp. But four-margin stamps, in my opinion, are worth, depending upon the eye appeal, how the cancels are, there are so many factors, they're worth between $500 and $1,000 retail.
Which does tend to reduce the number of people who can accumulate a large number of them.
They used to sell for the $200 range. But if you want to do a plating, 200 times 40 starts adding up.
That was the point of his comment.
Yeah. But there are people out there today that I know who are putting together platings, and some are doing it on cover. Some are doing it just like this. And even myself, like I said, I've been putting together platings with different signatures and overlapping, which is much more difficult, because then you need pairs. And incidentally, pairs are relatively common compared to a strip of three or larger. There are only three blocks known. There's a block of nine. There's a heavily restored block of six on a restored cover. And if you saw the before and after, you'd understand what I mean by restored. And there's an off-cover block of four. And that's it in terms of multiples blocks in a block form. There used to be a block of 10 as part of the New York Public Library collection, which is the bottom two rows, which were stolen and cut up, and it no longer exists in block form, period. Other than that, the next largest, there are strips of three, known on and off cover, and I believe the strips of four are the next largest, or the next largest size. Other than the block of nine, I don't know of anything larger than a strip of four. They're very, very rare, strips of three or larger.
Well, Stanley, thank you so much for your time and sharing with us your vast knowledge on this topic.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, and anytime. I know we focused more on the New York provisional, but believe me, the other provisionals are equally interesting. The St. Louis provisionals, if I can just put this in, are known in, there are three different plating, three types or formats of the plates. And those are plates of six, and they've been put together, and some of the St. Louis stamps are exceedingly rad. The papers are different. Even the New York is known on three different papers that are in the catalog, even though they're known. If you take the sub-varieties, there's probably five or six different types of paper that were used. And if these were issued much later, they would be in the catalog today. The St. Louis, I mentioned, the Providence, the most inexpensive postmaster provisional out there is a 5-cent Providence postmaster provisional, because there was a pad of them, but a large block of them that was all glued together that was used as a doorstop for many years. That was discovered many years later, and most of the sheets come from there. And in terms of a sheet, they're relatively common. Maybe there's 20 to 50 or more sheets known of them, and there are thousands of Providence provisional stamps. And you can own the 5-cent Providence provisional, you know, in the $100, $200 range. The 10-cent is much scarcer because one out of 12 is a 10-cent. 11 of them are 5-cents. They're also very easy to plate. And unfortunately,
yeah, being only one position, it is kind of cinch.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the number of covers are very rare, and used Providence provisional stamps are worth 10 times what the unused stamps are worth.
Wow.
And the Baltimore stamps have been plated. The Brattleboro stamps are much rarer, but again, they've been plated and everything.
Okay, well, thank you again, and we'll see you in Riverside.
Yes, see you there, and have a booth there.
Thank you.
Anybody wants to come by, they can come by.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you, Stanley.
Bye.
So this week we have Tom opening the 4806
inverted Jenny sheet.
Inverted Jenny sheet to see if it's a good one or not. And if it is, we're not going to tell Cash because he left early.
I saw the outside of the envelope, so congratulations. My heart just jumped. I'm like, oh no, you just purchased the sheet. I'm like, I know that. You can see how many of these I've opened.
If Tom turns white or incredibly red,
he'll regret putting the scissors in there to open it up.
No, I won't.
Yay,
it's not it.
Apparently Cash is still here in effigy.
Okay, maybe next time. You can email us at stampshowhereToday@gmail.com, Twitter at stampshowht, Facebook stampshowtoday, or our website www.stampshowhereToday.com with your questions and comments and complaints, please. You can now leave your questions and comments on our Google Voice answer machine anytime. Nobody will pick up. It's just an answer machine. At country code 1-949-873-4298. There's also a link to a Google Voice on our website so you can call from your computer. And on that note, keep collecting.
But was it well centered?
No.
Oh.
I'm Brian Metz with OCStampStore.com with your stamp tip of the week. When you're looking at your 10-cent 1851 to 59 issue and you've eliminated type 1, type 4, and type 5, there's only type 2 and type 3 left. The easy way to tell the difference between the two is simply to look at the top. Type 2 is complete above the left and the right X's, whereas type 3 is not. You will see breaks above the left and right X. For more U.S. stamp tips, sign up for my newsletter at OCStampStore.com.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurfs, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today. Return to sender, address unknown.
no such number.